Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, this week, the Louisiana State Legislature. Yeah, they have one. Passed one of several bills introduced during this session. The session is now ended because there is mercy in the universe. One of several bills introduced during this session to abrogate the ability of the levy authority, the professional levy authority that has jurisdiction over the fine new protective system, the risk reduction system, in the Corps of Engineers built for New Orleans, abrogate the ability of that authority to sue 97 oil, petroleum, and oil services companies for their derogation of duty when they built more than 10,000 miles of canals and pipelines through wetlands that protect New Orleans from storm surge and hurricane force winds, having signed contracts that they would make it nice when they were done, which they never did. The state legislature decided that the levy authority retroactively should not have the ability to sue the oil companies. Yeah, I know. I studied the Constitution in high school, too. Retroactive laws, ladies and gentlemen. Kind of a throwback, but I did say Louisiana. Anyway, Rob Virchik, who is on the faculty at Loyola and wrote a wonderful book recently that I've quoted from several times, wrote an opinion piece on Saturday in the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Yeah, they still publish it sometimes. The Sometimes-Picayune. Drawing on the research of other authorities, legal authorities, that this law would also abrogate, sort of willy-nilly, the power of other legal authorities to sue oil companies, suits that are already in progress. But it's retroactive, so who cares? Ladies and gentlemen, we teach democracy. That's what we do. We can't help ourselves. So, you know, after the Arab Spring came, Arab Indian Summer? So Egypt's outgoing interim president, because they had a nice thing in Egypt going on, the outgoing interim president, can you feel more temporary than that? That didn't stop him from issuing a decree making it illegal, a criminal offense, to dishonor the Egyptian flag or to not stand for the national anthem. Just like us. It's punishable by up to a year in prison and a fine of more than $4,000. The decree increased penalties suggested by the government late last year. The presidential decree says the flag and the national anthem are symbols of the state that must be honored. So they picked that up from us. I'm busting my buttons with pride. And we haven't talked lately on this broadcast about missile defense, for good reason. It ain't defending us against any missiles, but now a senior U.S. officer says if an upcoming missile intercept test results in a repeat failure, because its system has failed in several tests up to now, it still would not likely spell doom for the program. Of course not. Because the people who wanted to spell doom don't give money to congressmen running for office. Admiral James Winnefeld, vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said his own best guess is that the planned test this month of the ground-based mid-course defense system will be successful. Were the test deemed a failure, quote, I don't think it'll be a shot in the head to the program, but it depends on the failure mode. What are there, fashions in failure? I guess there are. The ground-based mid-course defense system is the country's principal defense against a limited strategic ballistic missile attack. It has not had a successful intercept test despite repeated attempts since 2008. I was being fair. After conducting an extensive technical analysis into the reasons behind the recent test failures, the Missile Defense Agency is planning to put the technology through another intercept trial later this month. If it is a success, said Winnefeld, candidly, it will be a very good shot in the arm for the program. So if it succeeds, it'll be a shot in the arm. If it fails, it won't be a shot in the head. unquote, Admiral Winnefeld. Good shot, sir. Hello, welcome to the show. From Southern California, home of the world's only $2 billion basketball franchise. Thanks to Donald Sterling acting like a proper Donald, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And ladies and gentlemen, this is your brain on the war on drugs. The front door to Barbara Thomas's home in Cashmere Gardens in Houston, Texas was damaged. And her outdoor garden lights outside were crushed into tiny pieces. Inside her home, several items were broken and knocked off the walls. She said it was a result of Houston police officers who came to her door to search for drugs. But you know what? You know, you have heard this story before. They were at the wrong house. There were guns everywhere, said Thomas. I mean, the long guns with lights on them. I didn't know they had those. Those are cool. Those sound cool, dude. Thomas says she didn't understand why Houston Police Department narcotics officers were in her home. She lives there with her son, who's autistic. There you go. And said they were both forced to sit still in the living room. Three officers were right there, having guns pointed directly at me and my son, and the rest were going through the house. Officers went through her bedroom, her closets, and her kitchen looking for drugs. Then one officer said, "Something isn't right here. This is a mistake." HPD said they're not able to say much about the case because Thomas has filed a complaint. However, a spokesperson said there was a mix-up. Officers were looking for 5818 on the street. 5818. Thomas lives at 5816. They're supposed to be able to read numbers, too. Really? After the spokesperson said officers didn't enter the home. She said they realized it was the wrong address, apologized, and left, but Thomas tells a much different story. They did try to fix the door and stuff and pick up the little stuff they threw around, but that was it. They have not apologized to her autistic son, said a community activist, nor have they offered to repair the door. Thomas said she isn't asking for much. She would like an apology and help making repairs to the items that were broken. She also said she wants to be reassured that a mix-up like this won't happen again. Good luck with that. They do. Ladies and gentlemen, yes, we teach democracy, but maybe we're not the ones to teach about torture. Now, you may have followed this story. The two psychologists, contract psychologists hired by the CIA, who had studied the Air Force's procedures for mimicking the Chinese communist torture methods to prepare Air Force people for whatever happened, what might happen to them if they, were downed. And the psychologists reverse engineered that program to create the system of enhanced interrogations that we proudly used. But Brazil's 21-year-long dictatorship, less well-known than that of Argentina or Chile, was still brutal. Hundreds died and thousands were imprisoned and tortured. One of those tortured was a left-wing guerrilla who's now, in this nutty, the country's president. She set up a truth commission to unearth long-buried facts about the past. As former victims and a few military players come forward to give evidence, the secret role of Britain as torture tutor has emerged, reports the BBC. Brazil's rulers in the 70s were engaged in a bitter struggle against left-wing guerrillas. Swept up in the opposition were union leaders, students, journalists, and almost anyone who voiced opposition. One of the most feared torturers, Colonel Paulo Malhaes, gave 20 hours of testimony, arriving in a wheelchair looking frail. Oh, the poor guy. The poor deer. He then confessed to killing and mutilating his victims. So maybe the karma thing. He also expressed great admiration for psychological torture, which he felt was more effective than brute force. Those prisons with closed doors, you can modify the heat, the light, everything inside the prison, he said. That idea came from England. He admitted privately to the prosecutor he himself had gone to England to learn interrogation techniques that didn't leave physical marks. Quote, according to the prosecutor, the best thing for him was psychological torture. When a person was in a secret place, it was faster to obtain information. He also studied in other places, but he said England was the best place to learn, unquote. Oh, the karma train made another stop. Malhaes was murdered in a burglary at his home shortly after giving evidence. Professor Glaucio Suarez interviewed more than a dozen of Brazil's top generals in the 1990s. Several of them told him they sent officers to Germany, France, Panama, and, the United States to learn about interrogation, but they praised Britain as having the best methods. Quote, the Americans teach, but the English are the masters in teaching how to wrench confessions under pressure by torture in all ways. England is the model of democracy. That's a quote from General Ivan de Souza Mendes. General Auer Fiusa de Castro said the British recommend interrogating a prisoner when he's naked because it left him anguished and depressed, a state favorable to the interrogator. The UK was apparently seen as having effective practices as it had faced a serious insurgency in Malaya up to 1960 and had then honed the techniques in Northern Ireland. The method using sensory deprivation coupled with high stress came to be known as the five techniques. These were standing against a wall for hours, hooding, subjection to noise, sleep deprivation, very little food and drink. Sound familiar, Mr. Cheney? Yep. It sounds very enhanced. Many argue the techniques amounted to torture. They were officially banned by Prime Minister Edward Heath in 1972. After a furor, or as they say in Britain, a furore, over their use on IRA internees. But in Brazil, these psychological interrogation methods fulfilled the military's need. The regime's dismal human rights record was beginning to attract adverse publicity. The old physical forms of torture were killing too many victims, a method that would leave no marks and was still effective to extract confessions or information from prisoners was exactly what the generals wanted. Not only did Army officers go on courses in the UK, British agents went to Brazil to teach. They gave courses inside Rio's military police headquarters on how to follow people, how to tap phones, and how to use the isolation cell. None of the military or police involved in the old regime has yet been brought to trial, so we taught them accountability, too. But I guess we still have a few things to learn from the Brits. The world of torture, ladies and gentlemen, slowly opening up for your listening pleasure. And now, news of our friend the Atom.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Save, cheap, too cheap to meet. Cheap, save, too safe to meet. Save, save, too safe to meet.
Our friend Addy the Atom is with us here today. Addy?
Yeah. Almost summertime. Makes me spin faster.
Why?
Void sunburn.
Really, if you move?
Yeah.
Los Alamos National Laboratory will not meet its June 30th deadline to permanently dispose of some 3,700 cubic meters of nuclear waste. That's the latest word from the Department of Energy. The plan known as the 3706 campaign became derailed by an underground fire and subsequent radiation release that closed the waste isolation power pilot plant near Carlsbad, New Mexico, the planned final destination for the waste. The department on Friday also revealed its plan to seal off areas of the WIPP where waste believed to be linked to the radiation release has been disposed of. About 96% of that waste has been removed over the last 2 years, according to the New Mexico Environment Department, which ordered the removal after a wildfire 3 years ago threatened the drums.
Oh no, not the drums.
Yes, the drums. A drum from a stream of Los Alamos waste is the focus of the investigation into the source of the radiation release at the waste pilot plant. A hot reaction occurred in at least one Los Alamos drum, cracking its lid and damaging others.
You don't really need the lid.
The waste pilot plant has been closed to waste shipments since the February 5 fire and February 14 radiation release. New Mexico Environmental Department said this week in a statement, it's disappointed, but not surprised, that the laboratory will not meet its deadline. The state is going to review potential options in regards to the larger consent order for all legacy waste cleanup at Los Alamos, said the department. Waste pilot plant managers have said it could be 3 years before the plant is reopened.
That's nothing. Stuff lasts for thousands.
Yeah. Before the removal campaign began, the drums of radioactive waste at Los Alamos sat idle above ground for decades. New Mexico Governor Susana Martinez made their removal a priority of her administration after that wildfire. The Department of Energy now proposes measures that would seal off areas of WIP, the pilot plant, where drums of nuclear waste believed to contain a dangerous mix of incompatible materials are being held. The closures would include steel bulkheads, and barriers include salt, chain link, and brattice cloth, a type of fire-resistant partition used in mines.
Oh, no, not mines.
Yes. New Mexico earlier this month ordered the Department of Energy to submit a plan to close one of the rooms where the hot reaction that led to the radiation release occurred. Department of Energy, citing the investigation, did not propose a complete timetable for closure of that room. Meanwhile, it could take months to seal an adjacent room according to the proposed timetable.
These things take time.
Everything takes time.
That's right.
The New Mexico order requiring the closure said the waste in those areas could pose, quote, an imminent and substantial endangerment to health or the environment.
People in New Mexico are such alarmists.
The state has extensive regulatory authority over the waste pilot plant as part of the legislation that enabled it to open way back in the early 1990s.
What's happening at Fook?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked, Addy. Water sampled from a well at the crippled Fook plant has been found to contain levels of radioactive tritium that exceeds the limit for dumping it into the Pacific, according to TEPCO.
So don't dump it.
Yeah. The discovery was the first report of over-the-limit tritium in groundwater at the well since TEPCO began discharging water into the ocean last week. Tritium levels in samples taken last month also topped the limit. TEPCO stopped pumping water from the well on Tuesday night this week and says it plans to step up groundwater monitoring.
More monitors.
Back to the pilot plant in New Mexico, the chemical reaction that shut down the nation's main nuclear waste disposal plant may have been caused by allowing materials which most chemists know are not compatible to be mixed.
Sounds like my first marriage.
You atoms don't marry.
We fuse. We fish.
Listener sent me a note this week that said, you know why you can't trust atoms?
Why?
Because they make up everything. The New Mexico Environment Department has made public online internal Los Alamos emails showing Los Alamos approved products to be used in the drums that some experts contain ingredients widely known to cause a heat reaction when combined with the drum's other contents.
Sounds like my first marriage.
Will you? The emails are not about the switch from inorganic to organic cat litter, a top theory of what caused the hot reaction at the waste plant. These emails pertain to other organic materials approved for use in the drums.
So cat litter has been cleared?
Cat litter has been cleared. It is such a relief to the cats. And back to Japan. Japan's government has announced it is going to replace two of its five members on the Nuclear Regulation Authority. They determine if a nuclear plant, is ready for a restart. Speculation is rising that the government is removing the seismic expert responsible for actually beefing up the requirements for nuclear plants.
They wouldn't do that.
The TEPCO is eager to spread the message that its Kashiwazaki Kariwa plant, one of the world's largest, is ready to be restarted after having been offline since the Fuke thing. Deputy Chair of the Nuclear Reform Monitoring Committee, Lady Barbara Judge.
Is she a lady or a judge?
She's a Barbara. She was the former chair of the United Kingdom's Atomic Energy Authority, supports an energy mix that includes nuclear power, even in Japan. Many continue to oppose the restart of nuclear power plants in Japan. Lawsuits are taking place all over the country, not only against nuclear power plants, but also uranium-related facilities. A lawsuit was filed to stop the Oi nuclear plant. The ruling was based on the fact that, quote, risk cannot be controlled by humans. Immediately, those who support nuclear energy began a campaign stating that zero risk is an old way of thinking.
Well, it ain't new.
Public trust in TEPCO also remains low, says Lady Judge.
Not Lady Gaga?
Lady Judge. TEPCO puts little films on their websites about what's going on. They're trying to explain to the public what they're doing inside of walls of power plants, which is new, and that's more important than anything in terms of regaining public trust. So, forget about the tritium. Concentrate on the little films.
All right, then.
Clean, cheap, safe. Too safe to ignore our friend the atom. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you? Award-winning news of the warm. How did that happen?
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
For the first time in roughly 2 million years, melting Arctic sea ice is connecting the North Pacific and North Atlantic oceans. The newly opened passages leave both coasts and Arctic waters vulnerable to a large wave of invasive species, according to biologists from the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center. Writing in Nature Climate Change, two new shipping routes have opened in the Arctic already. The Northwest Passage through Canada and the Northern Sea Route stretching through the coasts of Russia and Norway. You can see Russia from there. While new opportunities for tapping Arctic natural resources and interoceanic trade are high, commercial ships often inadvertently carry invasive species. Organisms from previous ports can cling to the undersides of their hulls or be pumped in the enormous tanks of ballast water inside their hulls. That's apparently how Formosan termites ended up in New Orleans, where they eat everything. Now that climate change has given ships a new, shorter way to cross between oceans, the risks of new invasions are escalating. Quote, transarctic shipping is a game changer that will play out on a global scale, says Lee author Whitman Miller. The economic draw of the Arctic is enormous. whether it's greater access to the region's rich natural resources or cheaper and faster inter-ocean commercial trade, Arctic shipping will reshape world markets. If unchecked, these activities will vastly alter the exchange of invasive species, especially across the Arctic, North Atlantic, and North Pacific Oceans. Unquote.
Yeah.
What could be wrong with that? I, for one, welcome our new invasive species overlords. News of the Warm, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
And have you ever loved so much it broke you into? Till you never ever dreamt of leaving? And have you ever thought that there's nothing I wouldn't do? 'Cause if you had, then you would never tell me, move on, move on. Be strong, as everyone must. But if you'd ever missed someone the way I do now, you would understand if you knew anything. Your heart is beating like a drum. Have you ever sat and prayed for that phone call to come? 'Cause if you don't, then you would never tell me, move on, move on. Be strong, 'cause everyone must. 'Cause if you'd ever felt the emptiness that I do now, you would understand if you knew anything. Anything about love.
From Southern California, this is The Show. I'm Harry Shearer, and now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. First of all, from The Guardian newspaper, capitalism is at risk of destroying itself. Who says that? Unless bankers realize they have an obligation to create a fairer society. That's the opinion of the head of the Bank of England. Mark Carney said bankers had operated a heads-I-win, tails-you-lose system. He questioned whether traders met ethical standards and said that those who failed to meet high professional standards should face ostracism. Speaking at a conference in the City of London, the bank's governor, he's like the head of the Fed. Imagine the head of the Fed saying stuff like this. He warned that there was a growing sense that the basic social contract at the heart of capitalism was breaking down amid rising inequality. Quote, we simply cannot take the capitalist system, which produces such plenty and so many solutions, for granted. Prosperity requires not just investment in economic capital, but investment in social capital. Unquote. Sounds like a Canadian, which he is. In a strongly worded critique of bankers' behavior in the run-up to the financial crisis, Carney said market radicalism and light-touch regulation had eroded fair capitalism, while scandals such as the rigging of LIBOR markets had undermined trust in the financial system. Quote, just as any revolution eats its children, unchecked market fundamentalism can devour the social capital essential for the long-term dynamism of capitalism itself. Individuals and their firms must have a sense of their responsibilities for the broader system. Bill Clinton attended this conference. Wonder what he thought. All ideologies, said Carney, are prone to extremes. Capitalism loses its sense of moderation when the belief in the power of the market enters the realm of faith. In the decades prior to the crisis, such radicalism came to dominate economic ideas and became a pattern of social behavior. Head of the Bank of England. They are wild over there. And former Conservative Prime Minister John Major says Tony Blair should ask the Chilcot Inquiry to publish his correspondence with George Bush about the Iraq War. This inquiry has been going on for 4 years. You heard some reports of some of the testimony from it on this program 4 years ago. But the inquiry announced this week it will only release the gist and quotes from those conversations, that correspondence and those conversations between Blair and Bush. This will allow suspicions to fester, said former Conservative Prime Minister John Major. He said it was a pity the full papers were going to be withheld by the British Cabinet Office. The inquiry has been accused of allowing a whitewash after it struck the deal with government ministers to publish the gist of letters between Bush and Blair, but not the full correspondence. The publication of the report has been overdue for several years. Discussions in recent months have focused on 25 notes from Blair to Bush and 130 records of conversations. After intense negotiations, the head of the inquiry has agreed with the British Cabinet Office the gist of the conversations can be made public, but direct quotations from the notes will be kept to, quote, a minimum necessary for the inquiry to articulate its conclusions. He has also agreed that use of material from the letters, quote, should not reflect President Bush's views, unquote. No decision has been taken on exactly which quotations from the correspondence will be published or how the gist will be phrased. Major says this will leave suspicions unresolved, and these suspicions will fester and maybe worsen. The mother of a 19-year-old soldier killed in Iraq has said she feels sickened by the decision to publish only partial extracts, calling it a whitewash. But fortunately for all concerned, lest the suspicions fester, we have a tape of one of the key conversations between Blair and Bush. Yes, it's an exclusive, and it's next here on the show.
Yeah. See, machine's running. Yeah. George, you're recording this? Don't worry about it. National security. Nobody ever hear it. So, Tony, how's the Blair Bear doing these days?
I'm fine, George. Really fine.
Great.
I know you're moving ahead with your compassionate conservative agenda, and on our side of the pond, we're pushing on quite successfully with our uncompassionate labor program.
Hey, good progress. That's the kind of progress I like. So, you're fixed for the beverage of your choice?
Oh, they brought me some tea, thanks.
Well, that's what that cloudy white stuff is in your cup. Mm. You know, I thought you were having to take a barium sample or something. You ever done one of those? Like drinking a tub full of chalk?
No, no, it's just tea.
Wonderful tea. So, listen here, Blairmeister. Mm. You know, we're only about 6 months away from pulling the trigger on Operation Mess Up Iraq big time. Your thoughts?
Well, in the first instance, it's an awfully unwieldy code name, isn't it? I mean,
Dick Cheney's got his folks working on a more user-friendly moniker. Hey, listen, if I microwave-managed every little detail of cooking up over in Dick's shop, next thing you know, I'd have to stay up nights reading Condi's intel briefings.
Well, yes. I mean, yes, we're putting the finishing touches on a dossier making the case for the war, if indeed we do decide that there's no alternative but to go along with our previously agreed upon course of action.
Well, dossier is good and all, but Maybe something on paper, too, don't you think? I mean, they can show you around and stuff. At least the dossiers I've met, but...
No, you're right. It will be on paper. Hmm? Good deal of paper, as a matter of fact. Nicely bound, as well as online.
So I can talk on my little phone here to your dossier?
I'm sure that can be arranged, George, whatever you require.
Yeah.
Remember, I'm not just your junior partner in the world's premier alliance. I am, as well, and always, your prayer partner. Can I get an amen?
Oh, amen. But now listen here, Tone. The old chain gang is worried.
And that would be...
Chaney. I call him the chain gang because he comes at you like a bunch of people, not just one guy.
Yes.
Also because his name starts with the word chain, so it's kind of like a little play on word.
No, I understand fully. But you were saying about Chaney.
Mm. Well, he's worried that you haven't yet got your parliament folks to write you a nice blank check on this Iraq thing. He's a little concerned. He thinks that that may be the fly in the adverbial ointment.
Well, what one has to grasp, George, is that we are fully in control of the information environment in which the parliament will be, quote, deciding this matter. The aforementioned dossier, for example, will contain a good number of passages which will have been redacted.
Hmm. So your folks will only see...
the black bars, totally obliterating what's underneath.
Hmm. And what is underneath?
Nothing. We'll have redacted blank space. But the tossers in Parliament will think there's some top secret something in there, some national security intelligence that's just too sensitive for their little heads. And they'll feel duty-bound to bite the bullet. And Bob's your uncle.
Well, as a matter of fact is, Prescott's my uncle, but...
George, you and I know that this project is too important to be left to chance. We're on the verge of something great here. There is simply no way I will let 600 febrile parliamentarians stand in our way.
You got that many? Shoot, we're three times your size and we only got, five-something. There's your problem right there.
George, what I'm trying to tell you is that I have no problem. We have no problem. You will never be in a position where you turn around and ask yourself, where has Tony gone? I'm right here for as long as the Iraq project takes. 4, 5, even 6 months.
Tony, if I didn't know better, I'd say it sounds like you got a lot of faith in me.
George, I've got a lot of faith, period.
Okay, well, let's go get ourselves some celebratory-ish burgers. What do you say?
And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for me to read the trades for you. You ever wondered if those online ads that are disguised as news stories, I'm sorry, content, are really effective? Digiday.com has examined the story. Does native advertising, that's what it's called, really perform as well as editorial? I'll read it for you. Lately, publishers have been crowing about the success of their native advertising. Some of it is doing so well, it's even outperforming some editorial content on their sites. At least that's what three practitioners have recently said in public forums. Lisa Camarillo, head of sponsored news at NetApp, said NetApp's sponsored stories on Forbes.com make it on Forbes' most popular lists as much as once or twice a week. To her, there's little difference between journalism produced by a brand and by a news outlet. Quote, "We're not necessarily focused on core content, but the way that you get the story, the way that you get to the story is the same. You've got to find the story, tell it in a way that's going to be intriguing. We're both after the same end game. We want to delight the reader." Unquote. Apart from the question of whether this is actually a good thing for the site's editorial content, the claim is counterintuitive, at least given what available research says about native advertising. Chartbeat studied the click-through rates of clearly identified native ads and found them to be between 1/10 and 1/3 of the surrounding editorial content. when visitors do click on sponsored posts, they were twice as likely to leave sponsored content than editorial content without scrolling down the page. That's right. They know whether you do that or not. No, it's important. As for engagement, Chartbeat says that while two-thirds of people engage for 15 seconds or more on a typical article, on native advertising that drops to one-third. That's right, they know how long you spend on a page. No, it's a good thing. Quote, in general, the native stuff has a very short lifespan, says Josh Schwartz, chief data scientist at Chartbeat. I can probably count, he says, on one hand, the number of pieces that were native that actually got large amounts of organic traffic. So the onus is on the publishers to drive the traffic. That's in contrast to a typical news outlet. It gets picked up by Google and Drudge and some social pickup. Unquote. The more clearly the ad is identified as native, the lower the response rate, which presents a conundrum to publishers given pressure from watchdogs to label native ads loud and clear so they don't look like they're trying to fool the reader. That would mean that publishers like Forbes, which labels its native ads with the discreet brand voice moniker, would theoretically have a higher success rate than publishers like the New York Times, which slaps paid post labels and disclaimers all over its native ads. But even Forbes, which has been doing this longer and more aggressively than most, said that over a two-week period, only 38 brand voice articles made its most popular list, 3% of the stories on the list. That's in line with the percentage of total articles on the site that are brand voice articles. Brands have work to do on the marketing part of content marketing, says Shane Snow, co-founder of Contently, which matches writers to native advertisers. Quote, finding and building audience is something that a lot of them think about secondarily to creating content, but it's extremely important to think about early, says Shane. Now, publishers seem to be retreating from their claims anyway. Meredith Levien, advertising vice president for the New York Times, said that in some cases, ad-sponsored posts have done better than traditional news stories. She gave the example of a United Airlines interactive graphic that generated almost 200,000 views, more like a typical editorial piece. More than a typical editorial piece. She later dialed back her comments, saying it wasn't a fair comparison, as some paid posts linger on the site a lot longer than news stories. In another instance, Anna Toll, assistant publisher for People.com, said some sponsored stories have done as well or better than editorial. Later, the publication said it had only happened once. So, advertisers, you better think twice before you go native. A conclusion I reach because I read the trades for you. I've been paid to tell you that it's a copyrighted feature of this program. And now let us try the motto of the United States Army Corps of Engineers. Here's what the Corps is up to now. A hotly contested permit allowing ConocoPhillips, that's an oil company, ladies and gentlemen, to build a road and bridge to a new oil field is now in doubt after a federal judge ruled that regulators approved it without fully considering environmental impacts. This is in Alaska, where they got to still have an environment. U.S. District Court Judge Sharon Gleason, in a ruling issued this week, said the Army Corps erred in the way it issued a wetlands fill permit that ConocoPhillips needs to build a gravel road and a road and bridge link for its oil field on the western north slope, as opposed to the northern west slope. Construction is already partly done, however, with the six-mile access road and pad installed and some bridge work finished over the winter. That's according to ConocoPhillips. However, the permit allowing that work is flawed, said the judge, because the Corps, which approved the permit in 2011 after previously rejecting it, failed to justify its decision to skip a supplemental environmental impact statement. The Corps should have considered further study to weigh modifications to the plan and potential impact to a North Slope environment already being altered by climate change, Gleason said in her ruling. The Corps offered only minimal explanation for its decision that there was no need for a supplemental study to add to the original environmental analysis done in 2004. The Corps, quote, failed to articulate a satisfactory explanation for its decision. The court concludes, therefore, that the Corps' decision was arbitrary, unquote. The lawsuit challenging the permit was filed last year by 7 residents of the Inupiat village closest to the development. To environmentalists and native plaintiffs, the road and bridge would imperil the Colville River, one of the Arctic's most ecologically important rivers. They argue ConocoPhillips road and bridge plans will impose new development sprawl on the western north slope, breaking an earlier promise by predecessor company ARCO to develop the area without roads over the sensitive tundra. But ARCO isn't good there anymore. Their promise is null and void. Whether the Corps will have to complete an after-the-fact supplemental environmental impact statement is not known. The judge ordered the parties submit information to be used to craft a remedy to what she identified as the permit's flaw. Speaking of such things, if you're ever in doubt about how the Corps of Engineers deals with the environment, there's quite a fine book called Paving Paradise by 2 Florida reporters about the Army Corps' 30-year history enforcing the no net loss of wetlands provision of the Clean Water Act, the result being major net loss of wetlands. But they did try. U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, let us try. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Well, let's start off with Army 4-star General Eric Shinseki. Until very recently, head of the Department of Veterans Affairs.
I apologize as the senior leader of the Department of Veterans Affairs. I extend that apology to the people whom I care most deeply about, that's the veterans of this great country, to their families and loved ones who I have been honored to serve for over 5 years now. It's a call of a lifetime. I also offer that apology to members of Congress who have supported me, to veteran service organizations who have been my partners for 5 years, and to the American people. All of them deserve better from their VA.
And so saying, he then, at the end of the week, resigned. The sincerest form of apology, it would seem. French video game developer Ubisoft apologized unreservedly this week after an Australian office was evacuated and a police bomb squad called out in a public relations stunt gone wrong. Ubisoft was promoting its latest release, Watch Dogs. It sent a copy of the game in a black safe to a Sydney reporter's office on Wednesday with a note telling him to check their voicemail. But the reporter, which does not review video games, did not have voicemail. And the safe, of the type found in hotel rooms, started to beep when colleagues tried to open it. Police were called to the Central Sydney building and staff were sent home after the company found out other media organizations did not receive a similar package. Officers forced open the safe in the basement of the building and found the game inside. We unreservedly apologize to the staff for the mistake and for any problems caused as a result. At Ubisoft, it said the delivery didn't go as planned. We will take additional precautions in the future to ensure this kind of situation doesn't happen again. The stunt was described by an official of the company as ill-conceived. The public relations agency, quote, no doubt got carried away with their creativity. That's what it was. Deadline Tucson, the University of Arizona officials apologized about the heat-related problems during the Tucson school's May 17th outdoor graduation ceremony. Thousands of graduates had to wait for hours in near 100-degree heat in Arizona Stadium, where adequate water either wasn't available or visible to graduates during the evening commencement. It's Arizona. The Arizona Daily Star reported that paramedics treated at least 8 graduates for dehydration and other conditions, and that several guests were taken to a hospital. Associate Vice President of Student Affairs Casey Urquidez says she's sorry for the shortcomings that drew numerous complaints, and said the entire commencement planning team feels terrible about what happened. Dateline Boston manager Ramirez apologized this week for his behavior with the Boston Red Sox in his first public appearance since being hired as a minor league player coach. With another team, his apology came before a pregame ceremony in which the team honored the 2004 team that won Boston's first World Series championship. since whoever knows when. Quote, I realize I behaved bad in Boston, Ramirez said. The fans were great. I also played great when I was here, but I realize I behaved bad. I apologize for that. I'm a new man, unquote. Apparently, he'll be using adverbs from now on. Deadline Pittsburgh, the head of a St. Louis-based religious order has apologized for sex abuse allegedly perpetrated by eight of its religious brothers who taught or worked at a high school in the Catholic Diocese of Pittsburgh decades ago. The allegations against the Marianist brothers began to surface in March after the diocese learned that a former teacher, Brother Bernard Hartman, is awaiting trial in Australia on charges he abused four students at a Catholic school there in the 1970s and 80s. First, I apologize to the victims who have suffered. Some of you, for many years, wrote the Reverend Martin Solma, the supervisor of the Marianist province of the USA. In asking for forgiveness, I only hope that the misdeeds of these brothers do not entirely nullify the service and witness of others who've served the mission of the Diocese of Pittsburgh more faithfully. The religious order runs 19 high schools in various parts of the country, including the Pittsburgh School, formerly known as simply as North Catholic. Deadline Salt Lake City Senator Orrin Hatch has apologized for making political comments during a Memorial Day ceremony earlier this week. The Utah Republican senator said in an interview he didn't mean to offend anyone when he made comments about the federal health care law and religious freedom during the Monday event in Salt Lake City. If I offended anybody, I certainly apologize because it would make me feel really badly that I did. The apology comes after veterans advocates said it's inappropriate to inject politics into a day that commemorates those who've died while serving the armed forces. Because, of course, the armed forces serve in conflicts totally untouched by politics. Deadline West Berlin, New Jersey. The management of New Jersey Water Park Sahara Sam's Oasis is apologizing for an email issued to some subscribers. The email arrived with the subject line Amber Alert, with the S in lowercase and the other letters all caps. Some of the recipients posted their displeasure with the message on a Facebook page, pointing out the similarity with Amber Alert. Management is quoted as saying on its Facebook page, we are deeply sorry for sending the email newsletter in which an error used to play on words in reference to the Amber Alert system. The email subject line was not approved for circulation. And in trying to be creative, there's that word again, our team made an error which may have resulted in a segment of our newsletter subscribers receiving this correspondence. We realized this mistake and quickly reacted. Our entire staff sincerely apologizes for any offense this may have caused. Deadline Stevens Point, Wisconsin. The Stevens Point school superintendent has apologized after a teacher gave a graduation gift of cleaning supplies to a student and reportedly told her she'll be, quote, scrubbing toilets. Alyssa Alvarado's family was offended by the gift bag from Sue Felder, a teacher in the Point High School Life Skills Center. It helps students with cognitive disabilities learn things like cooking, cleaning, and housekeeping. Alyssa's mother said she was offended by some of the items in the teacher's gift bag, like a toilet bowl, brush, and cleanser. She asked Alyssa why she was given those things, and she quoted the teacher as saying she'd be scrubbing toilets. Superintendent Attila Wedinger said Felder gave items she thought her graduates could use. She had no intent to demean the students. Wedinger said a firing would be inappropriate. In the future, the superintendent said gifts to life skills students will be appropriate for graduation and not like those Felder gave out. The incident comes more than a month after Stevens Point School Transportation Manager John Shepard sent a memo to bus drivers calling special needs students, quote, window lickers, unquote. After facing heavy backlash from many Jewish organizations and many Twitter users, MSNBC host Ture Neblett has apologized for suggesting a week ago that Jewish survivors of the Holocaust are benefiting from, quote, the power of whiteness. Sounds like a cheer commercial. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.490 megahertz shortwave on the Mighty 104 in Berlin, available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com, available via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it, KCSN.org and HarryShearer.com. and available as a free podcast from WWNO.org, Sideshow Network, SoundCloud, and iTunes. And it would be just like finding out what's wrong with that waste dump in New Mexico. If you'd agree to join with me then, would you already? Thank you very much. Tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, at home, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead and to Jenny Lawson at WWNO New Orleans for help with today's broadcast. Yes, I'm on Twitter. Are you? I got 99.1 thousand followers. Are you one of them? The Harry Shearer is the place to go. If you're in Seattle or San Francisco this week, Judith Owen with bass legend Lee Sklar is doing a show in your town. I think Seattle is Thursday or Friday. I know San Francisco is Saturday. It's pretty wild. And the email address for this broadcast and the playlist of the music heard hereon. And Cars I Talk t-shirts. They're all available at harryshearer.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station of the Change is Easy Radio Network. So long from Southern California.